Hello and welcome to Talking Finance. I'm Alan Kohler. Well, this week on the show, we've got James Gerrish talking about the market, whether it's a bear market rally or the start of a new bull market. And well, in preview, James doesn't know, but he's got some interesting things to say about particular stocks to look at. Stephen Koukoulis on the economy and whether there's going to be a rate hike tomorrow, which of course there is going to be, but Stephen is in the camp that says that's the last one. Tim Lawless brings us up to date on housing around the country after last week's housing report for January. And finally on politics, we've got David Spears, host of Insiders on ABC TV. And now here's James Gerrish, portfolio manager at Shoreham Partners and author of the Market Matters newsletter. Well, James, the ASX 200 is up 17% from its low in the beginning of October. Is this a bear market rally or is it a new bull market?
It's hard to tell, I guess, Alan. After you read the headlines, and it's certainly the bearish rhetoric is getting a lot of airtime, and I think that's what fed into the market's rally, particularly in January. All these investor sentiment surveys that I keep across, the market was universally bearish, positioning was universally bearish, allocations to equities were at really low levels, allocations to cash were really high. And then you got a situation where economic data suggests that perhaps interest rates aren't going to go up as much as some had feared. Inflation are showing signs of peaking, etc. So less bad news meets really bearish investor positioning, and the market rips over 6% on January. So I don't think it's the start of a new bull market. I think there's too many economic headwinds for that to take place. But if you think about the next 12 months, I mean, interest rates are not going to appreciate like they have over the past 12 months. And I think that's probably one of the key drivers that may well support equities over the coming 12 months.
Yeah, so the local market, the Australian market, has now recovered pretty much all of what it lost in the first half of the first sort of 9 months of 2022. Are we back to, and when you look at a bottom up and looking at stocks, are you finding it difficult to find bargains now?
Yeah, I think yes, but there's been a huge amount of variance across sectors. So obviously, the banking sector, which is really influential in Australia, has been quite strong. I mean, CBA is the leader there, and it's been incredibly strong over the past 6 months or so. So that sector's got tailwinds, but it's no longer cheap. But there are cheap pockets within the sector. If you think of CBA is trading on 18 times, it deserves a premium to the sector. But probably you look at CBA at 18 times and ANZ on 10 times. There's probably too much variance there. So you can position portfolios into the cheaper end of that sector. I think probably the resources, which are also influential. I think the resources, everyone's bullish the resources, which concerns me. The resources have been supported by a 12% depreciation in the US dollar index, which is now showing signs that that's going to have a counter trend bounce. So US dollar higher means resources lower. So I'm concerned about resources in the short term. I think they actually fall in the short term. I think banks remain reasonably well supported. Then there's obviously the market elsewhere is going to be dictated by company performance. So there's still huge amounts of variance. I think looking at the index is going to be a fool's game this year, Alan. I think at no time, I know it's a cliche, but at no other time in history, I think the stock picking and sort of active management around portfolio is more important.
And what sort of themes are pushing your buttons, James?
So on the resources side, so we've been selling into this strength in resources. So I think we'll get an opportunity to buy back in to the resources space later in the year at lower levels. We've got, I'd be more of a seller than a buyer of stocks like CBA at these levels. We've got a reasonable technology allocation, so we went a little bit early on that halfway through last year, but that started to really support portfolio performance. But again, I think you know, I'm a seller of strength and a buyer of weakness. I know it sounds that's easier said than done, but I think that, you know, active management around that and focusing on you know, stocks that are delivering from a performance perspective. So and there's a lot out there that are doing that. The other area that I'd highlight is the beaten down property space. We've seen a number of companies recently come out with less bad news. We're going to see a couple of property companies report this week. So I think the market's still super bearish on property. Some of these real estate investment trusts are trading 30-40% below their NTA, and their asset revaluations are coming through lower, but nowhere near what the market is pricing in. So
like what?
So you've got, so Centuria Office reported last week. Their NTA was down slightly, but they're trading a 36% discount to NTA. So everyone hates, obviously, there's a lot of uncertainty around how the office market plays out. But I think that the market's well and truly pricing the worst case scenario and more in companies like that. Dexus, we own in our income portfolio. You know, it's the biggest office landlord in Australia. I think that's, you know, that started to move in the last couple of weeks on the upside. Centuria Capital, which is CNI, they own around 14% of Centuria Office, as well as Centuria Industrial. So those companies that have been really kicked to the curb in the last 12 months, that's what we're seeing. We're starting to see bargain hunting flow into those areas of the market because the outcomes we're seeing in company performance aren't as bad as where the market's priced them. So,
and what sort of technology stocks are you liking?
So we've got, our major moves in technology recently. So we hold Altium, really high quality technology company. We've held it for quite a while, so we like that. We've actually, you know, Hub is part technology, part obviously, you know, investment platform. We've been a seller of Hub recently.
This is Hub 24.
So I think that the some areas in the market have become, you know, that's been really well supported over a reasonable amount of time, but their last quarterly was a weak one, and you're seeing it right across that investment platform space. And net wealth was weaker. The growth in Hub was weaker than it has been year on year. So to me, you've got to be focusing on, it's one thing to say we're buyers of technology or sellers of resource or whatever, but the company performance is really important. So, Ordinate is one in the technology space that we own that's been weak recently. A few machinations around the availability of chips, et cetera, has seen those shares sold down. So that's one I'd look at, the market. I think that's a really interesting story. What else in the technology space? So overseas, I mean, it's been, you see Meta has been obviously sold down massively over the past 12 months, but it reports better numbers and rallies 30% on the session. So it says to me that the market is still really negative and underweight tech. And I think the biggest negative influence last year on tech was higher interest rates, higher bond yields, and simply we're not going to see that in the next 12 months like we did in the last 12 months.
Good on you, James. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Alan.
And now here's Stephen Koukoulas. He's got a business called Market Economics. Well, Stephen, first question, I guess, is will we get a rate hike tomorrow?
Look, I think we will. It's a bit like calling the Melbourne Cup with 10 metres to go. You know who's ahead. You know what the pressure is. So, yes, I think they'll go. That they're, I guess, I won't say they're being bullied into it, but they're being coerced into it from the markets looking at what's happening in the US, obviously, the UK and European Central Bank all hiked last week and hiked aggressively. New Zealand's hiked a lot. And in a strange way, you know, we're part of that global economy. So even though all of the forward indicators for inflation are starting to tilt lower, I think the RBA just probably wants to make sure it squeezes inflation out of the economy. And that's why I think they're going to go tomorrow. Yeah.
Will that be the last one?
Look, well, I didn't think they'd need to go tomorrow, so I was wrong. So I was, you know, completely misreading the RBA's mindset on interest rates. I thought they'd be pausing at the end of last year at 3.1% for the official cash rate. Look, And the macro things haven't changed. You know, we do have a slowdown occurring. There's no question that the economy is cooling off both domestically and globally, even though the odds of a recession are a little less than they were, say, a month ago. The data out of the US recently has been generally okay. Same with Europe, and with China reopening, there's a bit of a shot in the arm for the global economy for 2023. But the slowdown's happening. Inflation is decelerating. Just look at the broad commodity indices, the supply chain delays, or the lack of delays now in getting stuff delivered. That's an important part of the disinflationary pressures that are there. And even though we saw a blockbuster US jobs report last week, curiously, the wage momentum is starting to decelerate a little bit there too, which sort of feeds into that lower inflation narrative.
So, I mean, what are the chances, firstly, of a US recession and an Australian one?
The US recession is more likely than the Australian one. They've hiked more aggressively than us, and they have a few other structural problems occurring in their economy. And certainly the numbers that have been coming out on the US economy are generally weaker than here in Australia. So the odds do favour one. There's a wonderful checklist that I keep in touch with on terms of the recession indicators. And most of them are either bright red, which is pointing to a recession, or the deep orange, which are pointing to the high probability of recession. So about the only thing that's not screaming recession right now is the labour market in the US. Everything else is. For Australia, yes, we're slowing down, but one of the things that makes me confident, or two of the things that make me confident that we won't have a recession in the traditional sense, is that business investment is still pretty good. We know from the NAB survey that businesses are a lot more optimistic than consumers in the economy. And the other one is the staggering growth in population. So, yeah, maybe in per capita terms, GDP will be sort of near zero or maybe a little bit negative through 2023. But, you know, bottom line, GDP is still probably going to be about 1.5% to 2% through this year, and that's not a recession.
So what do you think we can see happening over the next 12 months?
Yeah, look, we had to have the slowdown. It's the slowdown we had to have, I think, in 2023, and that's occurring. You know, we know retail sales, we know housing construction, house prices, these sorts of things are all a negative. And, you know, if we take Treasurer Jim Chalmers at his word just even over the weekend on the budget that's, 3 months away now, roughly, he's going to be keeping a relatively tight hand on the fiscal settings, you know, banking the windfall revenue that they've got from the high iron ore and coal prices and these sorts of things. So the government's not going to be stimulating the economy to the same extent. So the slowdown's happening. Unemployment will creep up and the inflation rate will fall. So the current debate, and we might get a bit of extra input from the RBA on Friday with their statement on monetary policy, is the speed at which the unemployment rate goes up and where will the peak be. You know, if we get to 4.25%, I think we could call that a soft landing. 4.5% and above, that would be a little uncomfortable. And then linked to that is how quickly inflation falls from the 7.8% that we saw at the end of 2022. By the end of 23 and into 24, will we be back at the target range or still a little uncomfortable at 4%? And the jury's out. And that's where the current debate about monetary policy and the RBA action is all about, you know, with that trajectory for lower inflation.
Good on you, Steve. Thanks.
Thanks, Alan.
Now here's Tim Lawless, Head of Research at CoreLogic. Well, Tim, in last week's housing price report for January, you kind of made the point about how much house prices had gone up in each of the capital cities and across the country. It was up sort of 25-odd% and now down just under 10%. But is the point you're making that what we're seeing is a reversion to mean? Or do you think we're getting more than that?
Not necessarily a reversion to mean. It's probably more just making the point that we saw quite a spectacular upswing, as you say, Alan, up about, nearly 26% in a little bit less than 20 months. And now we're seeing housing values on the downside of that. We definitely haven't seen all those COVID gains being wiped out. In fact, the market's across the combined capital, still a little bit more than 10% above what it was at the onset of COVID back in March of 2020. So most capital cities still showing quite a substantial valuation buffer, for one way to describe it, but there's a lot of variation here. Look at somewhere like Melbourne, for example. I'm pretty sure in the next week or so, we'll probably see our Melbourne index getting back to where it was at the onset of COVID. It only needs to fall another 0.4% from the end of month to get to that level. Sydney's about 7% higher than what it was back in March of 2020. But then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got markets like Adelaide still 41% above pre-COVID levels. So, definitely the point I was trying to make was just quite the spectacular upswing and now a record level of downturn, but the context was the important thing.
I suppose the question is not so much whether it's going back to where it was before the pandemic, but is it getting back to the long-term trend, which is an uptrend, obviously? So do you think house prices are basically going back to their long-term trend or beyond that?
Yeah, I think they probably will get back to the long-term trend. We know the market is obviously very cyclical, so it'll probably see quite a large correction in values. We are expecting probably somewhere around a 15% drop from peak to trough until we start to see the market flattening and then ultimately once again starting to rise again. And any sort of rise in housing values is generally dependent on some sort of a spark or a catalyst, be it interest rates coming down or maybe a relaxation in some of the credit controls, particularly the serviceability buffer from APRA, or what we've seen in the past around stimulus for different segments of the market, like first home buyers has been another factor. So, I wouldn't expect the market to start turning around anytime soon, but I think once we do see interest rates stabilizing, that's when we'll gradually start to see a more obvious flattening out of prices.
One of the things that really jumped out at me about your report last week was Adelaide, which COVID trough to peak was 44.7% and so far declined only 2.1%.
Yeah, it's finally Adelaide's time in the sun.
Perth similar, 26 up and less than 1% down. I mean, Adelaide and Perth, wow.
Yeah, I mean, they're very different markets. Remember, Perth has come out of an extraordinarily long and weak cycle. It's only recently we saw Perth recover the peaks from back in 2012, whereas Adelaide's generally been just a fairly steady performing market. And I think for both of those areas, it's the sheer affordability of housing in those markets and some positive demographics that are helping to keep those markets relatively stable. But if I look at the trends at the moment, and I'm just looking at our daily index, which does look like it's gathering some downwards momentum for both of those markets. So there probably is a bit of a lag here. We're not expecting either of those cities to record as much of a drop as, say, a Sydney or a Brisbane or a Melbourne. But it does look like the downturn is now underway and gathering a little bit of pace.
I must say that a 45% increase in prices in Adelaide is not stable.
No, that's quite the spectacular upswing, but it comes after a very long period where Adelaide definitely could be described as one of the more stable markets. It didn't see the same sort of swings up or down that we saw in the major cities through the previous cycles.
So are you saying that, here we are, 6 days into February, and what are we seeing in your daily index, that momentum, downward momentum is picking up, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. It does look like the downwards momentum is picking up in both of those cities from...
What about elsewhere, Melbourne and Sydney and across the board?
Well, it looks like the growth trends or the decline trends in Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane have eased off. It looks like they've moved through the worst of their cycles, probably around August for Sydney and Melbourne. Later than that for Brisbane, more like around end of last year for Brisbane. But each of these markets is now seeing a more moderate rate of decline, but still at monthly declines in both of these, all three of those cities. That's still a little bit above 1%. That's still a pretty fast clip of falling values. Even just going back to the previous downturn that ran between the middle of 2017 and 2019, we only saw a few months where values were falling faster than 1%. So it certainly seems to be sustained at the moment with quite a rapid rate of decline. But yeah, absolutely, it does look like it's moderating.
The other thing you highlighted was the strength of rents, obviously, which are rising strongly. There's very low rental vacancy rate around the country. And you reported on gross rental yields. Now, the rental, the residential rental market appears to be renting, yielding about the same as the share market, which is unheard of.
Yeah, remember, these are gross yields, so maybe a little bit overstated if you interest rates. So gross yields, absolutely, they're back to above pre-COVID levels now after, you might remember, during the worst of the pandemic and when prices were rising really quickly, that pushed or compressed rental yields down to record lows. So they're rising off record lows quite quickly in a gross perspective. But when you factor in the cost of debt, there's really been no improvement in rental yields, even though rents are rising, you know, 10-odd percent year on year at the moment. The fact that we've seen the cost of debt, or you know, even just if you're on, say, a $500,000 mortgage, you've roughly seen nearly $1,000 added to your mortgage or payments in a month. We haven't seen rents rise that much in dollar terms. So, yeah, a little bit different when you look at the net scenario.
What about vacancy rates? I mean, are we at peak or trough vacancy? I mean, and would does that mean it's a good time to invest in residential property or not?
We've moved through what's probably the bottom of the vacancy rate cycle, I think. There's a bit of seasonality at this time of the year, so probably one to watch. So through December and January, we saw our capital city vacancy rate lift from about 1.1% up to about 1.3%. So a little bit of a lift. I mean, 1.3 is still remarkably low. And I'd expect it to remain very low, even if there's a little bit of volatility. The reason for that is, even though there's probably some readjustment of domestic demand, as we see domestic renters once again form larger households, reversing that pandemic trend towards smaller households, I think that will be more than offset by the rise in overseas migration, particularly foreign students, which is you know, really just flooding into rental demand now, particularly around inner city markets. If you look at some of those inner city regions, like inner Melbourne's probably the best example, rents there are up nearly 40% in the past 12 months. But of course, that comes after these are some of the weakest markets through the pandemic. Melbourne, inner Melbourne rents fell about 26% through early COVID, and now they're up like 40%. So well and truly recovered from that dip.
Thanks very much, Tim.
Always a pleasure, Alan.
And now on politics, here's David Spears, host of Insiders on ABC TV. Well, David, you devoted pretty well the entire show, or at least most of your show, Insiders, yesterday to The Voice. So how defining an issue is The Voice going to be for Australian politics this year?
Well, it clearly is. Any referenda is clearly a defining moment for Australia, whichever way it goes. And I think on this issue in particular, where we're talking about, in part, grappling with Australia's history, the wrongs of our past, in some part trying to rectify that through the establishment of an Indigenous voice to Parliament, this is going to be a significant historic moment. But politically, yes, it's also very important for the Albanese government, and we can come to Peter Dutton as well, but we know Anthony Albanese in his victory night speech in last year's election made it very clear this was a priority for him. He wanted to achieve this referendum this year, this term, and that will take place in the second half of this year, most likely October or November of this year when you look at the timing of the legislation and when it can be held. So the Prime Minister has staked a lot on this, but it really and clearly is more than just about the political consequences for the Prime Minister. As I say, this is a very significant moment for Australia.
But obviously the opposition has staked its positioning on politically on details. We want details. You know, a couple of what you might call ordinary voters that I speak to have kind of come around to that and said, yeah, well, I want details. So do you think that Anthony Albanese is going to have to, in order to make this work, to get the referendum up, he's going to have to produce details?
Yes, I think some. I don't think we'll see all of the fine detail that Peter Dutton is demanding. And some of the questions, the 15 questions that Peter Dutton has put forward, look, you know, things like how will they define Aboriginality as to who is entitled to stand for The Voice or be nominated or elected to The Voice. I mean, we've defined Aboriginality very clearly for a long, long time. Governments do it all the time. We have so many Indigenous organisations that don't. This is not an issue for them. So some of those details.
But they could answer it by simply restating current definitions, right?
Exactly. Current definitions are there. But some of the other questions that he poses, I think, are fair enough and are the sort of questions that Australians are after. I just also think there's a lack of awareness, understanding at the moment on the basics of what the voice is. I don't think a lot of people are really tuned in to what is being suggested here, what is being put forward. So there needs to be, yes, a bit more detail, and that will come with more principles, according to Professor Megan Davis, who we spoke to this week on the show. She's a key driver of all of this and a significant member of the referendum working group. There will be more principles, more information, but then it comes down to selling it, right, and having a very clear message out there and a clear place where people can go to find information on this. And I think a bit more coherence amongst the various yes advocates too. At the moment, I don't think that's really come together very well, but we're told it will in the coming months.
Just big picture, David. I mean, obviously, Anthony Albanese is focusing on this. Meanwhile, ministers like Mark Butler and others are focusing on administrative details of their portfolio and doing quite a bit of reforms. Obviously, Butler is focusing on Medicare, had that announcement last week. Do you think what we're going to see this year is ministers reforming the kind of the machinery of government? And the Prime Minister sort of above all this focusing on the referendum?
Look, I think the Prime Minister can't afford either in a policy delivery or a political sense to be completely out of the action on all these other areas. I don't think he can be above it or simply focused on the voice referendum. I think he inevitably will have to get involved. And we're seeing that with the, you know, Alice Springs response at the moment as well, but on all sorts of other areas, whether it's reviewing the RBA, the Medicare review, what's happening with AUKUS and the nuclear submarines and defence strategic review, all of these things will involve the Prime Minister as well. But he's not a Kevin Rudd micromanager. He's not a Scott Morrison control freak. He is more of the hawk style in the short time that we've seen him in the role, where he is willing to delegate a lot more responsibility to his ministers. And I think so far you'd have to say that's been a good approach, letting the talent on his front bench, be it Penny Wong, Jim Chalmers, Mark Butler, Tony Burke, in the arts policy and industrial relations, do their thing, while not completely divorcing himself from all of that, but giving them a lot more rein.
Yeah. Just on Jim Chalmers, how do you think he's come out of the essay gate, if I could put it that way?
Look, I think any treasurer in a a typically quiet period on the political front who ventures forth with an essay trying to explain his ideological approach to the job is bound to spark a flurry, but a fury of responses is probably a better description. I quipped yesterday that it was a 6,000 word essay and has had 60,000 responses, and it has been quite remarkable. Some of them have been way over the top, labelling it a sign of Marxism in the Treasurer and so on. I read the essay. I found it quite thoughtful. I didn't think it was entirely radical. Nor did I think it really laid out in too much specific detail where he intends to go. He's left himself enough wiggle room, right, to do pretty much anything in the budget. There will be expectation when he talks about values-based capitalism that he'll now do something about stage three tax cuts or the job seeker rate. So he's raised the bar for himself there. But I think he's left himself enough scope to move.
Yeah, okay, that's very interesting. Well, thanks very much, David.
Thanks, Alan.
And now, David, perhaps you can introduce today's musical birthday.
Well, today is Bob Marley's birthday, or it would have been. He died in 1981. He would have been 78 years old today. For me, there was a wonderful holiday many, many years ago with some great friends where we spend every day listening to Bob Marley. So whenever I hear it, it instantly relaxes me, takes me back there. And so here's some Bob Marley with the one and only No Woman, No Cry.
No woman, no cry. No woman, no cry. No woman, no cry. No woman, no cry.
That's all from me. Take care. Have a great week.